All right, please be seated. All right, the court is called to order. The court calls the case of the United States versus Captain Zachary B. Braun. In today's oral argument, we consider the following issue, whether trial counsel's argument amounted to prosecutorial misconduct that warrants relief. Mr. Hockenberry, are you prepared for oral argument?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. And Major Wright, are you prepared to proceed with oral argument?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. Mr. Hockenberry, do you wish to reserve any time for rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor. 10 minutes, if I could.
So granted, you may proceed.
Senior Judge Anikstad, members of the court, may it please the court. My name is Scott Hockenberry. Captain Sam Castanian is at counsel's table. Along with Mr. Brian Prestero, we represent Captain Braun. Your Honors, 5 years ago, almost to the day, the CAF held in United States v. Voorhees that an Air Force senior trial counsel committed clear and obvious error by vouching. The CAF said it was disturbing a senior trial counsel would think the arguments were acceptable, and the blame was shared by the military judge, the supervisory government attorneys, and the defense counsel for just sitting by and letting it happen. Yet in this case, 5 years later, the special trial counsel is still making the same improper arguments, and the military judge, the supervisory chain, and the defense counsel are still just sitting by and letting it happen. And when I say the STC is making the same improper arguments, in places it's almost verbatim. In Voorhees, the STC says, she's not lying, it's the truth, it's what happened. Here the STC says, she has not lied to you today. Everything she told you is the truth. She's doing it because it's the truth. It's what happened to her.
Captain Hockenberry, or Mr. Hockenberry, can I, before we get into the specifics of what was said during the argument, I'd like to talk a little bit about how our Superior Court has defined vouching. How is vouching defined in the law?
Well, Your Honor, in this case, you're not always going to have that, of course, but here, it's so similar to precedent that it's almost easy, and to arguments that precedent finds constitute plain and obvious error. So there's different types of vouching. There's, I would kind of say, two here. One is vouching for the credibility of the witnesses, and the other for sort of the verdict or for guilt, and you have both of them repeatedly here.
One of the things that CAF, our Superior Court, stated in Voorhees, you know, was the idea that impermissible vouching occurs when trial counsel places the prestige of the government behind a personal assurance that a witness has, or that the evidence into a witness's veracity, you know, for example. So again, it encompasses this concept of, you know, places the prestige of the government. I was wondering, are there examples of that in trial counsel's argument in this case, where you think are clear examples of senior trial counsel placing the prestige of the government behind him?
Right, Your Honor, and I think that comes from the Supreme Court's decision in Young in terms of the danger of vouching. And in Voorhees, there were some arguments where trial counsel sort of invoked his own position, and some where he didn't, and the CAF found plain and obvious error in both. But that is not required. It's not required to say, I as the representative of the government am telling you the witness is credible, or I am the representative of the government and I'm telling you he's guilty. In Norwood, for example, there was not that dynamic. And in fact, the government on appeal made a similar argument that unlike Voorhees, the trial counsel is not saying, by virtue of my position, I have more credibility.
Okay, so just to break it apart a little bit, that kind of discusses the prestige of the government. Then again, another part of that definition that our Superior Court has given us is the personal assurances. So when I think of vouching, obviously, and you can come up with any number of synonyms, promise, guarantee, pledge, vow, you know, are there examples of senior trial counsel in this case using any of those words where we can see a clear personal assurance made by trial counsel?
Right. Well, again, Your Honor, I think the case law is clear. That's inherent in these sorts of statements. And again, the government made a similar argument in Norwood, sort of the statements being, for example, the victim told you the truth. It wasn't, I assure you the victim told you the truth. And the government in Norwood argued, well, that's not vouching because there's no personal assurance, as Your Honor puts it. But again, the CAF resoundedly rejected that and found plain and obvious error. So it's not required that the trial counsel say the words, I assure you. It's inherent in the statement. And again, the statements here are so similar to the statements from Norwood and in many cases, for many, many cases in that matter. Your Honor, subject to Your Honor's questions, of course, I'd like to cover three areas. First being the standard of review, the second being why the error here was plain and obvious, and third, prejudice. What I won't be doing is just repeating all the arguments or points from our brief due to time constraints and just because it's not helpful just to repeat the briefs. But on the standard of review, it's plain error. Trial defense counsel should have but did not object to the improper arguments. There must be error. The error must be plain and obvious, and prejudice are the standard. I do want to point out the first and third factors are the same for preserved and unpreserved error. The only difference in the case of unpreserved error is the second factor, that it must be plain and obvious. And the good news for appellant is that the plain error standard in the context of improper argument is not too daunting of an obstacle.
So, counsel, on the evaluation of prejudice, who has the burden to show that there is prejudice with any plain error evaluation?
Your Honor, the defense has the burden, except in the case of constitutional error, where in constitutional error, whether the error is preserved or unpreserved, the burden is with the government beyond a reasonable doubt.
So are you alleging constitutional error here?
Some of the categories, Your Honor, would be constitutional error. The burden shifting, the comment on constitutional rights in particular. So with the standard in mind, I guess my second topic or heading is that the error was plain and obvious. And again, there's at least some good news for appellant in that military courts, and particularly CAF, have been quite willing to find plain and obvious error in improper arguments. The CAF found plain and obvious error in Voorhees, Norwood, Fletcher, Clark, Carter, Marsh, and Andrews. And the reason is because the rules on proper versus improper argument are well established. And to the extent that an argument violates a well-established prohibition, the error tends to be plain and obvious. For example, in Norwood, which came after Voorhees, CAF said, our precedent explicitly prohibits vouching. Trial counsel did not comply with that precedent. And in the next sentence, CAF says the error was obvious. Similarly, in Carter, CAF said, in light of the well-established prohibition against characterizing the evidence as uncontroverted, the error was plain under the second prong of the plain error test. And as a final example, in Marsh, the CAF found plain and obvious error when the argument violated federal circuit court case law. That was about personalizing the argument. And speaking of the federal courts have been quite willing to find plain and obvious error in improper argument as well. It's actually relatively rare. It's not unheard of, but it's relatively rare for military courts to say an improper argument was improper, it was error, but the error was not plain and obvious. And again, the reason why is because the rules on proper versus improper argument are well established. In a couple of categories, the arguments here are almost verbatim to arguments that have been found to constitute plain and obvious error in precedent, the vouching, and the sort of charge to the panel to do the right thing by convicting at the end of the rebuttal argument, which is almost verbatim to the closing comments the Ninth Circuit found constituted plain and obvious error in Cruz. So those categories are great because we have such factually on-point precedent. Of course, you're not always going to have that. Of course, that's not required, but in places we do. And in Cruz, of course, the Federal Circuit reversed for that error alone. Here we have essentially an identical error compounded by a number of other errors.
Mr. Hockenberry, what about the role of context? So you've done a very good job of pointing out specific quotations and how they were stated in the Brom case, as compared to how they were found inappropriate in our appellate cases. But what does the role of context play when we consider whether or not there is a plain and obvious error?
Yes, Your Honor. I think the government's point here, judging from their briefs, is that trial counsel was tying these arguments to the evidence and would sort of discuss the evidence for a while, and then these quotations are sort of a summation of the discussion of the evidence. And I suppose my response to that is that the government made very similar arguments on appeal in Voorhees and very similar arguments on appeal in Norwood. And in both cases, the CAF resoundingly rejected them. I'd also point to Fletcher, because Fletcher is great because we have the entire closing argument, which the CAF included as an appendix to the CAF opinion. And trial counsel in Fletcher, she talks about the evidence a lot. So it's not that there was no discussion of the evidence or it was completely untethered from the evidence, but just talking about the evidence and then engaging in these vouching comments, that doesn't cure the error, and you don't get immunity just by talking about the evidence. And in fact, the structure of Fletcher, it kind of mirrors some of the government's arguments here. Right at the very end of closing, trial counsel in Fletcher says he is in fact guilty of the charged conduct. And that was one of the errors that the CAF highlighted as plain and obvious and reversed.
Mr. Hockenberry, are trial counsel allowed to argue in findings that the accused is guilty of the offenses as charged?
Yes, Your Honor. Yeah, case law is clear. Carter talks about that, as do I think all of these cases, that you can certainly talk about these topics, but it's the form of the argument that is improper when arguments like these are made. So certainly those topics are the very core of the controversy. It's just the method of improper versus proper.
So counsel, so where is that line of injecting their personal belief, and I'm talking when I say they, I mean trial counsel, injecting their personal belief or opinion into the veracity of a witness in particular? Where's that line? Can they not say that was the truth? Can they not say that was a lie? Do they now have to introduce something in additional to say, in my opinion, da-da-da-da-da? Do they have to introduce and say, in my experience? I mean, this case is not Voorhees. I mean, this is not the trial counsel standing up and say, I travel around the country and only convict guilty people. I mean, this is not Voorhees. I think just kind of piggybacking on where Senior Judge Anikstead's questions were, where is the additional commentary beyond just a comment on the evidence that puts the trial counsel's position, belief, opinions at issue at all? Is there a single reference in his hour-long argument where he talks about, I think this, I believe that, I opine this? Where can we find that in this argument?
Right. Well, again, Your Honor, there was that aspect to Voorhees, but there was not that aspect in Norwood, and the CAF found plain and obvious error in Norwood. And again, that was the government's argument on appeal, sort of along the lines of your question, was that there was not what the CAF called in Voorhees. The CAF made sort of a snide comment. They said trial counsel is vouching for his own credibility. And that aspect was not necessarily there in Norwood, but again, that was still plain and obvious error. So that's certainly not a requirement.
Well, it was certainly something that was also apparent in Voorhees. You know, the sort of idea that trial counsel was bolstering their own credibility in front of the members. So I think what, if you can gauge from our questions, kind of where we're going is this isn't as simple. And this is kind of where we're hoping that you can help us, as you highlighting three or four words that trial counsel said in this case and comparing it to statements, three or four words in another case. And that I think where Judge Douglas's questions have gone, the context of the entire argument, the context of the entire trial, as CAF recognized in Voorhees, matters. You know, when we're trying to interpret what trial counsel's was doing in their argument and whether or not what they were doing was, or what they said or what they argued was proper. So is there anything else you can provide as far as, you know, other examples from the court or you know, other sections of their argument that you think really paint a picture for us as to where trial counsel was going?
Right, Your Honor, I don't think there is the aspect like in Voorhees where trial counsel is sort of building up their own credentials and saying, you know, I don't convict the guilty people in that. But again, that was not present in Norwood either, and there was still plain and obvious error in Norwood. And I don't think it's just a few words. I think it is, you know, the government makes vouching arguments throughout the brief. I have pages 1099, 1111, 1116, 1117, 1118, 1120, 1128, 1131, 1138, 1142, 1143, 1144, 1145, 1212, and 1213. This is widespread. And of course, the vouching goes along with all of the other forms of improper argument as well. So I agree with Your Honor's questions in terms of there's distinctions between this case and Voorhees. But when you look at other cases, like Norwood that followed Voorhees, those distinctions those distinctions were not there in Norwood either, and I would say the arguments here seem quite a bit worse than Norwood. So the idea that sort of some of those comments that did exist in Voorhees but are not here were a requirement to finding plain and obvious error, I don't think that's supported by precedent.
If I can shift the focus here a little bit now and kind of move. There was a pretty, I will say, aggressive argument by trial defense counsel in this case. How does that play into what trial counsel is permitted to say?
Your Honor, I don't think the defense's argument in any way opens the door to improper argument by the government. The CAF talks about that in Carter and rejects the idea that improper arguments could be justified because they were made in response to defense attacks on witness credibility. Footnote 2 of Voorhees says something similar. There's many ways to respond to a defense theory. Engaging in an improper argument is not one of them. In United States v. Smith, the Ninth Circuit says attacks on the credibility of the witness are a legitimate tool of advocacy and do not trigger the invited response
rule. So, counsel, let me shake out that argument a little bit. So the trial defense counsel in this case stood in front of this panel of members for almost 2 hours and basically and repeatedly, incessantly called the alleged victim in the case a lying liar. She's lying. She lied. And that is a fraction of the number of times in which they said that in this record. Is it your position then that after hearing that, the trial counsel now creates plain, obvious, prejudicial error when they stand up and say she's telling the truth? Is that your argument?
Yes, Your Honor, for a couple of reasons. First, I don't think there's an implication either in your question or in the government's argument that the defense argument was improper. But even if the defense argument
To the extent that I'm not clear in that question, yes, it was improper is what I am implying and saying. Mm-hmm. So in that light, what allowances, if any, does that give to the trial counsel?
Right. Your Honor, that would give no allowances, assuming impropriety in the defense argument. The case law is very clear that the kind of catchphrase is two wrongs don't make a right, and the defense or the government response to improper argument by the defense is to object, not to make improper arguments themselves. That's in Young, which is sort of the leading Supreme Court case, and that's in many cases on improper argument after that. But I also think that it's different when the defense makes statements like that, because the defense does not represent the government, does not represent the state, and does not have the prestige of the government behind them. And then I'll return to prejudice on rebuttal, but there's just one other category of improper argument that I want to highlight in terms of the plain error, the second prong, I should say, of the plain error, plain and obvious error. And that's the trial counsel's arguments that if the defense attacks on the victim's credibility worked, no victim would get justice. And trial counsel makes some version of that argument on pages 1210 to 1212, mostly on 1212. The government's answer cited this court's decision in United States v. Leach, a 2020 decision. It was cited for a different proposition, but in Leach, this court found plain and obvious error in a very similar argument about how the defense theory would impact the victim's future ability to consent or not to consent. In Leach, this court called that argument speculative and collateral and wholly irrelevant, and again found plain and obvious error. If anything, trial counsel's arguments here were more speculative, more collateral, and more irrelevant because trial counsel was talking about the impact on other unrelated victims. So I do want to return to prejudice, but there's not time here, so if it's all right, I'll return to that on rebuttal and pending Your Honor's questions.
All right, thank you.
Thank you.
All right, Major Wright, are you ready to proceed?
Yes, Your Honor.
All right. We're only showing a minute and 30 on the clock here is where the question's coming from. All right, thank you for your patience. You may proceed.
Senior Judge Annixted, members of the court, may it please the court. I am Major Jocelyn Wright, and along with my co-counsel, Colonel Matthew Talcott, we represent the United States. Trial counsel's arguments were a fair response to defense counsel's trial theory that attacked the victim's credibility beginning in voir dire, moving into opening statements, on cross-examination, and into closing argument. Trial counsel's comments were not error constituting prosecutorial misconduct. Trial counsel is allowed to argue the credibility of witnesses. As with all argument, it needs to be tied to the evidence or an instruction or directly rebut defense counsel's arguments or claims. But trial counsel is allowed to argue that a witness is credible per this court's decision in Blackburn. A court should not lightly infer either that a prosecutor intends the most malicious version of an argument. Our Supreme Court has said that we should not infer the most damaging meaning or infer that a jury took a comment to be so damaging as to require some kind of intervention by the appellate court. The most important component of this case, Your Honors, is that trial defense counsel never objected during court. And that is the time for these types of issues to be resolved. Trial defense counsel, did not deem it necessary to intervene with any of these comments because in context, trial counsel's comments were made and tied to the evidence or were directly responding to defense counsel's claim throughout the trial that
Major Wright, did the trial counsel do anything inappropriate?
There was at least one comment, Your Honor, that we do agree was inappropriate, but not prejudicial.
Okay, can you please state what that one comment is?
Yes, Your Honor. So we would agree that the comment, quote, this is not the kind of flying that can be approved by the Air Force with regards to the Article 113 offense. We would agree that that is an improper invocation of the Air Force, however, not prejudicial because it was not flying an Air Force vehicle, it was a civilian aircraft, and it was more of a throwaway comment, just kind of a side comment that didn't necessarily affect the outcome from the panel. We shouldn't be worried that that one comment affected the decision of the panel to convict on that offense.
Just on that point, was there any information, any evidence that was presented during the trial, testimony, documentary evidence, or the like that would have discussed the fact that he, Captain Brown in this case, is an Air Force pilot or introducing any sort of flying regulations or standards?
Your Honor, looking through the record, there's no documentary evidence connecting the flying to his Air Force career. They would have known that he was part of a flying squadron with the flyer. That information would have been on there saying that he was part of the refueling wing. But there was no testimony. There was testimony that he knew how to fly and that he was a pilot in the Air Force, but there was no Air Force regulation because we weren't invoking any kind of Air Force aircraft or anything of that nature. It was her testimony about the sexual acts that occurred in the aircraft that a reasonable panel could determine that was a violation of Article 113.
Hazardous. So essentially, you would agree that there weren't any facts or evidence presented on that and that trial counsel shouldn't have argued?
Correct, Your Honor. We do agree that is error, but not prejudicial. So looking at the context of the remaining arguments, as Your Honor asked, that is the most important piece of any improper argument analysis, is to look at the context. And we do not have a trial counsel that is vouching, using the prestige of the government behind his statements to vouch for guilt or to vouch for a victim's credibility. A trial counsel is permitted to stand up in front of a panel and say, this individual is guilty. And the court in, I believe it was Carter, stated that even uses of the terms absolutely and the truth when tied to the evidence are not problematic. The Ninth Circuit in Cruz, though an unpublished case, did overturn for improper argument talking about, I believe it was this is the truth. Let me make sure I have that correct. Excuse me, do the right thing. But in that case, it was not tied to the evidence. And the court specifically said it was improper because it was not tied to the evidence. That theme runs throughout the jurisprudence on improper argument. It must be tied to the evidence or to an instruction or in direct response to some kind of claim by defense counsel. And that is what this trial counsel did in this case.
So let me ask you, you started your argument, you know, essentially saying that there was a theme that ran through this trial from voir dire, you know, till through sentencing, you know, concerning the credibility of the victim in this case. Are there limits on a trial counsel being able to rebut or respond to a theme or theory or argument from defense counsel?
There are limits, Your Honor, and that limit is the nexus between the evidence and the instructions. And trial counsel in this case repeatedly referred back to the evidence, tied it back to statements made in testimony by the victim, tied it to physical evidence. He repeatedly went back to that evidence. If you look at the context, typically before or after a statement where he's talking about her telling the truth, he's reiterating her testimony about potential motives to fabricate or different events that occurred. So he is tying it to the evidence. He may not say, I am tying this statement that she's telling the truth to this evidence, but it's apparent from the order of his argument that he is referring to the evidence throughout.
So it isn't a matter, you wouldn't be arguing that it isn't a matter of degree. So depending upon how zealous a defense counsel's argument may be, you know, the more zealous it is, the more leeway that trial counsel would get in being able to respond to it. You wouldn't say that the law permits that?
The law does permit it to a degree, Your Honor. Typically the severity of the case allows for more zealousness. I believe the Supreme Court has said that if we have a case where the conduct by the, or the alleged, excuse me, the charges are extremely severe, we do not expect trial counsel to sit idly by and make, this is not their term, but a more vanilla argument. The government is permitted to zealously advocate for their client, just as defense counsel is permitted to zealously advocate for their client. However, the context is what determines whether or not that is the appropriate amount of zeal, or it's overzealous. And our courts have said, look at that context to determine that.
And so what's the danger of these improper arguments? Why are they not allowed? Why is a trial counsel not allowed to vouch for a witness? What's the danger?
The danger occurs when we cannot be certain that the members convicted the appellant on the basis of the evidence alone.
Okay, so keeping that in mind, obviously there's a balance, right, between allowing the trial counsel to be the zealous advocate versus protecting against that danger. Would you agree with that?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, so I think everyone would be agreeing and be mindful of the fact that you don't want to turn trial counsel's argument into a meaningless event of the trial by limiting them in so much in their ability to be that advocate. Do you agree with that?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, so in that light, though, what is the utility towards their end of being the zealous advocate in saying she's telling the truth? Why do they need to say that? How does that move the ball in any direction that they're trying to get to in any way other than to say, well, this counsel, who we know represents the government, who is the prosecutor, is now telling me she's telling the truth? What's the utility in us allowing that argument to take place?
In this specific case, Your Honor, he ties it typically to...
I get that. I hear you, and I'm not trying to derail you from what I want you to stay focused on what I'm asking from that standpoint. What is the utility of allowing him to say she's telling the truth versus, members, based on XYZ evidence, you can conclude that she's telling the truth? Obviously, there's nuances in all of these different things. One or two words can make a difference. We all understand that. What's the utility in allowing this trial counsel to have made the statements that he made?
The statement, she is telling the truth, may not have been phrased how this court would want it to be phrased. It may be inartful, but in this case, it's not improper because he tied it to the evidence and explained, for example, with regard to motive to fabricate, this is why she doesn't have a motive to fabricate. There was no divorce proceedings. There was no custody battle. There was no request for alimony. He goes through those facts near saying those words, she's telling you the truth. It is indirect, a direct rebuff of defense counsel's argument that started with 9 questions in voir dire about reliability, credibility, or lying, and then 13 of 48 lines in the opening statement that stated she was lying or unreliable or not credible. And then the first question on cross-examination by defense counsel was, quote, so when you were dating appellant, you were comfortable with lying. And then in closing arguments, defense counsel continued that theme and theory throughout by, as Your Honor pointed out, saying she lied repeatedly. The statements she's telling the truth is a direct response defending the government's evidence. Her testimony was the main evidence in this case, and her credibility was of central importance to whether or not the panel found her credible. But every time trial counsel referred to the truth, he tried to connect it to that evidence and to the reasons why she was credible, or the fact that though there may be inconsistencies, you can still believe her, you can believe portions of her statements, which is what the panel is instructed on. They are instructed on their duty to determine whether or not a witness is credible. And trial counsel refers to that duty throughout his argument when referring to the credibility argument. He does not invoke personal pronouns like I or we, which were problematic in Fletcher. He uses the term you when referring to the credibility, the duty of the panel to determine credibility. Now, understanding personal pronouns can become problematic when you're talking about a golden rule argument. That is not the argument he was making. He was reiterating the instruction to the panel. And what's important as well, speaking of instructions, is the essentially the curative instruction provided by trial counsel at the end of his rebuttal. He said, to the extent that anything in my argument or the defense counsel's argument does not correlate with the law, you should follow the law and the military judge's instructions. And again, defense counsel never found these statements so problematic as to require any kind of objection. And the military judge under Knickerbocker has a sua sponte requirement to intercede and make some kind of curative instruction if the judge at the time believes that the statements warrant it. We, looking at hindsight, are not supposed to scalpel out these certain portions and say, well, these were problematic. The people in the trial at the time have the best understanding of the tone and tenor of the argument and to determine whether or not a objection is necessary.
How much weight should we give to the fact that there were not objections and not a intervention or instruction, curative instruction given by the military judge? I mean, considering the fact that both sides agree that at least in one of these arguments, there was an erroneous argument presented by trial counsel without objection, without intervention or curative instruction by the judge. How much weight then should we give to the fact that they, for the rest of the argument, no objections, no intervention, no curative instructions?
This court should use the plain and obvious error standard. And when evaluating the different comments, that is the weight this court is required to give when there's no objection and the objection has been forfeited at trial. This court should look at, again, the context. They likely didn't object because it was tied to the evidence. It was tied to an instruction. They didn't deem it necessary to intercede. And there's no claim that they were somehow asleep at the wheel. They were paying attention, and trial counsel was mindful throughout the trial of potential objections. For example, in voir dire, there was a question about two witnesses. Sometimes the government may only present one witness, or two people may be the only witnesses to a crime. And trial counsel objected to the original phrasing of that voir dire question and then provided an alternative. So they were paying attention.
When you say they're paying attention, you're giving us trial counsel examples. If we're talking about trial counsel argument, what assurances do we have that trial defense counsel and the judge were understanding, again, as the parties seem to have agreed, at least one of these arguments was error? So how much weight should we give to the fact, again, kind of getting back to my question, if we don't have objections from trial defense counsel, we don't have an intervention by the judge on something that parties here say this was error, how does that relate to the rest?
According to United States versus Gilley, the lack of an objection is some measure of the fact that the statement wasn't problematic. Now, with regard to that one statement in the context of a 54-page argument, it was not so problematic that the trial defense counsel needed to draw attention to it. It was, again, more of an offhanded comment that while problematic, defense counsel likely had a strategic reason for not objecting.
And I want to piggyback on that. So how much, if any, should we presume, apply, guess that the lack of objections were a strategic decision? I mean, given the trial defense counsel's, as I commented earlier, enthusiastic representations that this individual, this witness, was lying, as well as their repeated alignment of themselves with the members, saying we, putting them in the position of the accused when they said you and talked about when you were in these domestic violence relationships, when you are in BDSM, and putting the members in the positions of the accused. Did they just want to be able to do these things, and how much can we pay attention to that? What's your position on that?
And, Your Honor, just to clarify your question, are you asking, essentially, were they erroneous in their argument?
How much should we consider the fact that defense counsel didn't object, considering this is what they did in their argument, all of these improper arguments and improper things that they did? Maybe they didn't want to object because they didn't want to be restricted on their own. Should we pay attention to that?
Yes, I think we should pay attention to it in that it was, again, a fair response for trial counsel to respond to it. Trial defense counsel is permitted to discuss credibility. The credibility of a witness is always at issue in a trial. They made it their central theme and theory. And while there was no objection to their zealous advocacy, they understood that they were permitted to discuss credibility. And then in response, trial counsel is also permitted to respond and say the victim is credible. They're saying she's lying. We are saying she's not for these reasons. And he, again, connected it to the evidence. And the fact that that trial defense counsel did not object may have been strategic. We don't have an allegation of ineffective assistance of counsel for this claim, and rarely do defense counsel put their strategic reasons on the record. However, we have no indication that they were not paying attention and were not, again, zealously advocating for their client and ensuring the fairness of the trial. Now, looking to the military judge, again, has a sua sponte responsibility to ensure that an appellant has a fair trial as well. And the military judge did not find any of these statements warranted a curative instruction on his part either. And again, these are the individuals, the reason we have plain error standard is because these are the individuals who are responsible or who should be making these, litigating these issues at the trial level. That is the best time to make these cures to the record is at trial. And if the individuals participating in the trial deem it's not appropriate, then we shouldn't question them when we are separate from, when we are separated from that trial level emotion and advocacy. Even the most learned counsel occasionally get carried away in their advocacy. And this court has deemed it's not appropriate to overturn a case on improper argument unless there's a reasonable probability that but for the error, the outcome of the proceeding would have been different.
All right. So can I shift focus here? We've spent a lot of time, and you've got about a 30-year argument time left, at least on the clock. So we'll see. But if I could shift, there were other points of the argument from trial counsel that the appellant here has alleged that there are error, and I'd like to talk about one in particular. And this is, the appellant is alleging that trial counsel's argument, and I'll kind of quote if I can get this right, he likes BDM, that's clear, it's uncontroverted. And trial counsel, or the appellant is now making the argument that that's a statement on the appellant's constitutional right to remain silent, and that that's a fact that can only be challenged by the appellant. I will tell you, you know, that if you have read the case law on this, and I can tell from argument that both counsel have, that uncontroverted, you know, trial counsel saying that word, you know, has been highlighted a few times by our superior court as being something that's not appropriate to say. So can you talk a little bit about, you know, that? You've said that you've agreed that there was some error in the argument. Why is this not our error?
Your Honor, this was not error, first of all, because defense counsel admitted in closing that appellant also was interested in BDSM stuff. That's at 1183. So agrees with this exact statement. It is not a fact of consequence. Both the parties agree that he is interested in BDSM. And the reference with regard to the uncontroverted, within context, the very next line, the trial counsel says, quote, OSI told you about how they went into his home, right? And they find whips and ball gags and harnesses, everything. Clearly, appellant liked BDSM. Now, that is tied to evidence that is not the two people in the room. When we're looking at Carter, for example, which is cited for this exact proposition, in that case, there was no other evidence besides the testimony of the two individuals that were involved, the victim and the appellant in that case. Here, we have physical evidence that was found by OSI via a warrant. And that is what the statement is tied to, not to her testimony, which was the issue in Carter. They were saying in Carter, her testimony essentially is uncontroverted. But here we're not talking about testimony. We're talking about physical evidence that was in fact presented to the panel.
So in essence, what I hear you saying is that this was trial counsel making argument on reasonable inferences from evidence that was presented at trial?
Yes, Your Honor. And it did not invoke constitutionality, because it was tied to physical evidence that was separate from a situation where appellant is the only person who could rebut that comment. There could have been evidence presented about the fact that those items weren't his, or there could have been previous sexual partners who could have been presented to say, no, he's not interested in this type of thing. But neither party did that, and both parties agreed that this was a sexual proclivity that he had. But it was not a fact of consequence.
And you said that trial defense counsel conceded that point in his closing argument?
Yes, Your Honor.
So talking about prejudice, given that you're conceding that there's at least one improper argument, argue that it's non-prejudicial error, one of the things I believe we'll have to evaluate is the strength of the case. Is that right?
Yes, Your Honor.
All right. So if you would talk to us, please, about the strength of the government's case and why one or more of these arguments, if we deem them to be erroneous, were non-prejudicial.
The conviction in this case was based on, well, there's several convictions, but predominantly on the victim's testimony. We did have eyewitness testimony to one of the Article 128 offenses. And then we also had corroborating evidence in the flight log, the mile high pin, and the actual sex toys themselves. Those were all available in this case. And so this is not a case where it's just dependent on one witness's testimony. It is predominantly, yes, dependent on that. But her testimony was fairly consistent throughout. There were some inconsistencies that were addressed by the parties, and the panel took all of that into consideration when ultimately deciding the guilt of appellant. And they came back with mixed pleas, which is an important note for this court. They were very diligent in how they went about determining whether or not appellant was guilty. They spent 6.5 hours in deliberations, and they determined that he was not guilty on 4 different offenses, and they used exceptions and substitutions for 2 others. They were paying attention to the instructions as well, because they asked for reconsideration of a finding at one point. This shows.
And I apologize for interrupting. Is there any relation between the strength of the corroborating evidence and the lack of corroborating evidence and the particular findings? For example, you know, if they found him not guilty in one specification, maybe it was only on, based on testimony alone versus some of the other things that you're referencing. Is there any relationship between the mixed findings and the corroborating evidence?
There's not a clear pattern, Your Honor, that we could draw. This was persuasive for this reason. But we could speculate that, for example, oral penetration in the aircraft, specification 4 of charge 1, was a not guilty offense.
So just so I can connect the dots here, and I apologize for interrupting as well, but your argument here is that because there were mixed findings here, some where the appellant was found guilty and some where the appellant was found not guilty, that that's indicative that any impermissible argument didn't have any effect on the outcome of the trial?
It is indicative that we can be confident that the members convicted on the basis of the evidence alone because they were paying attention to the instructions that were given to them by the military judge, and we presume that the panel is paying attention to those instructions, one of which is that the argument is an exposition of the facts and not evidence.
Does it say anything to us about the weight of the evidence that was supporting the conviction, the fact that there were mixed findings?
It doesn't necessarily go to the weight, Your Honor. It goes to the diligence of the panel in determining the outcome of the case. We would argue that the victim's testimony was strong evidence of the offenses, and there was corroboration for many portions of her testimony to indicate that she was telling the truth. But looking at prong one, in addition to the weight of the evidence, looking at the severity of the misconduct, the frequency in the argument, the points that are not tied directly to evidence or tied directly to an instruction are extremely limited. We would argue just that one flying statement. And it didn't persist throughout the trial and the arguments and rebuttal. And the length of the trial was approximately 3.5 days. Length of deliberations was 6.5 hours of that time frame. And then, again, trial counsel followed the military judge's rulings and, in fact, provided his own curative instruction to the members to ensure that they were following the instructions of the military judge. May I briefly conclude, Your Honor?
You may. Briefly.
Trial counsel may argue credibility if there is a nexus to the evidence or in response to the defense counsel's argument. Thank you.
Thank you, Major Wright. All right, Mr. Hockenberry, it looks like the clock is cooperating with getting the time right here for your rebuttal. You may proceed when you're ready, sir.
Thank you, Your Honor. I did run out of time on prejudice, so I'd like to return there and fast forward to the third Fletcher factor, which Your Honor was asking government counsel about, being the strength of the evidence. I think that's probably the most important point on prejudice, and I think that can be seen in a lot of past military cases, including some of the high-profile cases where the evidence has been very strong, and so it's been hard to establish prejudice. And this is not one of those cases. The overall narrative of the prosecution was not particularly compelling, sort of a multi-month series of violent assaults, but the victim continued to actively pursue a romantic relationship with appellant the entire time. That's not the strongest foundation for a case, and when you look at the specifics, it gets much worse. Of course, B.E., the victim, won't give her text messages to the government, and then when the text messages do come out, they clearly don't support the story she's been telling. She says she wants no part of this so-called BDSM, but then the objective evidence, the text messages, she is sending extremely graphic messages to appellant that had her story to the government stood without the objective evidence, she never would have revealed. And it goes beyond the pictures. I won't get too gratuitous with it, but certainly her messages paint a very different story than what she was saying. And then another example, I'm sorry, Your Honor.
So in Voorhees, one of the interesting dynamics of that was by the time the Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces gets the case, we had set aside one of the specifications. And so many of the arguments that the CAF found to be improper weren't necessarily related to the remaining specification. Do we have any situation like that here? Obviously, we have mixed findings. Do we have arguments that are related to the specifications for which your client was found not guilty? Are they related to the specifications to which he was found guilty, or both?
Your Honor, I don't think there's any dynamic like that here. The improper arguments, their prejudice continues to the specifications that appellant was convicted of. And you're right, in Voorhees, right, I think there was a 120 that was set aside. And then the remaining offenses, I think, were 133s that were quite strong. I think appellant had conceded to some physical touching of a subordinate, and I believe the others were electronic messages to subordinates, and the government had the messages themselves. So in a case like that, it's just hard to establish prejudice. Carter was similar. I think there were two different confessions to CID that the notional victim was 13, or he knew, had knowledge of that. And there's been several cases like that. And I would say this is not one of those cases.
So can I ask you about the measures to cure any potential improper argument? So the military judge in this case, like military judges do, give standardized instructions to include reminding the members that it's their duty and their duty alone to determine the credibility of witnesses, during their review of the evidence, reminding them specifically that trial counsel and defense counsel argument is just that argument. It's not evidence in the case, and it can't be used by them in an improper way, that it's merely just helping them digest what came out during trial. Why doesn't that fix any potential error in trial counsel argument here?
Right, Your Honor, that would go to the second Fletcher factor, the curative measures. And I think it's pretty straightforward. In this case, there were no tailored instructions or specific curative measures, but there was, to Your Honor's question, the standard instructions. Those are curative measures, but of course that happens in every case. So if you have a spectrum of curative measures, this case is at the absolute bottom. You would never have a case with less curative measures than here, unless the standard instructions were omitted, which you would never expect to happen.
But then again, we don't get this argument in every trial that there's anything wrong with those instructions. You would agree that those instructions are accurate representations of the law, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
So is there anything wrong with, why don't those cure anything? It would appear through the argument presented by government counsel here that the members were extremely diligent after hearing those instructions and going back and deliberating for over 6 hours and really combing through the evidence to where they didn't just come back with as to all charges and specifications, guilty. Here they came back, and it would appear from their verdict that they considered each one of these individually like they've been instructed to do, considered the evidence that was out there and made specific findings, some guilty, some not guilty, and in some cases replacing certain language from the specifications to better fit the charges. So again, is there a reason that we should infer that those instructions didn't fix any potential problems by either counsel during argument?
Your Honor, the standard instructions, which again are given in every case, they are a curative measure, but to hold that they, if the standard instructions were enough, then you would never have plain error. And I think the CAF in Fletcher talked about how the standard instructions were woefully inadequate, and Andrews, there's similar language about the lack of tailored instructions. And Voorhees, the CAF is very critical of the judge, who of course gave the standard instructions, but very critical of not stopping the argument or providing a tailored instruction. So there is the standard instructions here, but again, you have that in every case.
Well, there were many examples in Voorhees, that jumped off the page of trial counsel placing the prestige of the government, behind their statements and arguments. And that, as our Superior Court noted, that started at voir dire, not just during argument. So I think more was expected of a trial judge in that case. But here we have a situation where we've got no objections at all from either side during either counsel's argument. I'm not seeing, having read the arguments, listened to the arguments, there wasn't anything that jumped off the page. Again, we're being asked to consider three-word and four-word sentences here. So, you pointed that, and I guess I'm trying to understand where you're coming from here, that, these are the standard instructions they're given in every case. These members don't sit on every case. These are new instructions for them, and there doesn't appear to be anything in the record that says that they didn't follow them. So, I'm wondering where you're going with, I guess, that they're standard and they happen in every case. So why does that make them bad?
Your Honor, they're correct, and they are a curative measure. But again, if the standard instructions cured improper argument, then you would never have plain error. I mean, that would pretty much eliminate any appellate review of improper argument. And I think the case law is clear the standard instructions are important. That's why we have them. But the case law is also clear that a military judge should be more tailored and more specific.
Where's the line that triggers that?
Well, Your Honor, certainly if we're in the realm of plain error, if an error is plain and obvious, then a military judge should stop it and should give a standard or a specific instruction.
Does trial defense counsel have an opportunity to ask the judge for a more specific instruction after argument?
Your Honor, a trial defense counsel should have but did not object to these arguments and stop them as they happened. I suppose trial defense counsel could wait until after the argument and then not object during the argument but ask for a curative instruction. That would be maybe an unusual procedure, but they certainly could. Returning briefly to the strength of the evidence, corroboration was limited and largely collateral. The victim admitted to telling a number of lies about things that really made no sense to lie about. And again, the objective evidence, in particular the text messages and the Amazon records, drastically undercut her testimony. It was a mixed verdict. To Your Honor's question to government counsel, there did not seem to be a real pattern to the mixed verdict. And there were even offenses that happened at the same time where appellant was acquitted of a portion of a single event and convicted of another portion. And I think all we can really read into that is it was a very close case, which to the third Fletcher factor would cut in favor of a finding of prejudice. I'd add that, again, some of the errors are constitutional in nature. On this record, this court should not be confident the members convicted appellant on the basis of the evidence alone.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Right, I would like to thank counsel for both sides for your outstanding arguments today. The court will render a decision in due course. This court is now closed.